Welcome to The Sounds of Sand, a podcast inquiring into the beauty and mystery of existence beyond ultimate truths.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are in the world. My name is Maurizio Benazzo.
My name is Aya Benazzo.
We are here in the territory of the Pomo and Coastal Miwok, also now called Northern California, Sebastopol. And we are delighted to be here with each and every one of you. Thank you. Should we start? I would like to read, Peter, briefly, a brief bio of yours. Everybody knows you, but just for, you know, to keep forms. Very brief. So, Peter Levine is a renowned developer of somatic experience. He holds a doctorate in medical and biological physics from the University of California at Berkeley and a doctorate in psychology from International University. Is the recipient of 4 Lifetime Achievement Awards, is the author of several books, including Waking the Tiger, which now has been printed in 33 countries and has sold over 1 million copies.
And today's conversation will be related to Peter's new book, an autobiography of a trauma, a healing journey. And Peter, as I just mentioned, I've been reading your book in the last 2 days, and I didn't think, you know, I am really tired from a lot of reading a lot of trauma since we did the film and everything. I was like, I'm just going to scan through the book and put it away so I know what we can. I could not stop reading it. It just moved me so deeply. It touched my heart, my soul, and it really brought pieces that, for me personally, that I didn't know. So I see your book is like a recapitulation of your life, and it transmits your wisdom and your healing realizations on the journey, along with evoking the mystery of life, like reflecting on this deep mystery we are embedded in. So all this layer just nourished my soul deeply. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you.
Writing it, and that's my first question, actually. What prompted you to write the book? And must have been very vulnerable journey to make the decision to share all of this publicly. Your childhood has been heavy and with a lot of deep, deep traumas. How those early experiences formed who you are and what you're giving to the world, what you're offering to the world. Many questions here, but
I think I have an idea where to start. When I wrote this book, it was not meant to be a book. You know, at my age, even though I'm pretty healthy and passionate, but the number of years I have left in my life is much less than the number of years that I have already had up till now in my life. And I thought it was time to really, almost like a journal, but to really excavate my life, to look at the trajectory, to look at the way, the experiences I've had, how I've dealt with them, how I've been able to find a coherent narrative to weave them together. And so again, it was just meant for me, for my own healing. And so, but anyhow, a very good friend of mine, I shared some of this with her, and she looked at it and she said, Peter, you need to publish this. You need to write this and publish it as a book. And I said to her, no way. It's too vulnerable. It's too personal. I mean, it's also intellectual, academic, scientific in some ways, but it's deeply emotional, deeply heartfelt. And she said, I really think that this book could help other people if you write it as a book. And so I felt really conflicted about this. You know, there was her idea that I do publish it, and then it was my fear of doing that. And sometimes, not sometimes, often when I don't know where to go, a dream comes and the dream guides me. That I don't have the knowledge from my conscious mind, but often my unconscious is starting to percolate and giving me important information. So I had the following dream. In the dream, I'm standing in front of this large field, and I'm holding in my hands a ream of paper in both my hands, and there's some kind of a manuscript or something written on it. So, and I look to the left, I look to the right, and then without thinking, in this moment of indecision, this breeze, this wind comes from behind me and takes all of these sheets and brings them into the meadow to land where they might land. And so when I awoke, I knew what the answer was. I was going to put "Let's go" for others to read. My hope was that it would help in their own healing. And if I didn't feel that strongly, and I really appreciated your feedback, Sahara, is that that this would really help people with their own journeys, their own healings, and maybe even to write their own stories. Because I deeply believe that we have, all of us, have important stories to tell, both to ourselves and to people who are kind witnesses. And I think, again, that's how I felt that really, you know, I mean, anytime you write a book, some people will say, you know, not so nice things about it. But I knew that I was supposed to be doing this. And even though I still had some ambivalence and some trepidation, I was on the way. And finally, when the book 2 days ago, I guess, was released, and I realized for certainty that there's no going back. and actually, I've been getting behind it. You know, the feedback I've been getting has been very, very touching. I just, out of the blue, received a text from somebody I knew 30 years ago, this woman in Denmark. We were very close friends. And she wrote, you know, something about how, said something like what you said. She couldn't put the book down and she kept reading. And she said she really got to know me in a different way. And she wanted to thank me for my projection. And I didn't know what she meant. At first, I thought that was a negative thing. But then she said, you know, you have also helped me with my projections, and I really honor the time that we had together. So, and that was what made it even more interesting, is the night before this, I had a dream of being in Denmark and coming to this beautiful garden of beautiful sculptures. And of course, she is Danish. So, but these are also the other things, dreams and synchronicities. When something like that happens and you think, well, it must be a coincidence, but it's not a coincidence. It's a co-incidence. It's a synchronicity, is of course what Jung called that. And that's also been a guiding light in my life and of course in writing the book.
And you share many of those visions and dreams in the book.
Yes.
It reading the book, it felt like peeling layers upon layers of your life and your trauma healing journey. I'm curious, like, is that how it's for all of us, that maybe when we start healing on the healing journey, we understand a little bit or we see a little bit, and with time we see more and more layers?
Yeah.
And why it took you 30, 40 years for you to touch on some of the deepest traumas.
Yeah. And I continue. You know, to answer your question, writing the book or making such an excavation is an unfolding experience. Something folds into something else. Oh my gosh, I just remembered. in the dream, there was this sculpture of something folding into something else, beautiful sculpture. So again, this is kind of like an example. We're just talking, and all of a sudden, these images are coming to life for me, a connection with somebody I had long not heard from. I mean, I have to say, it's really pretty wonderful.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And why does it take so long, so many years, for us to touch the deepest wounds? That those memories to emerge? Why do we suppress them so deeply?
Well, that's an important question. When I started writing this and then realized it was going to be a book, I didn't want to expose people to some of the violence that happened in my childhood. And in somatic experiencing, we never go for the core of the trauma. We work around the periphery in many ways. And that's one of the basic principles. It's very different than the idea of having people relive their traumas over and over again, like flooding or this kind of thing, where you just relive the worst of the trauma over and over and over. And I don't think that really gets anywhere. And so I was experiencing some disturbing symptoms, some difficult sensations, and some images come briefly into my mind's eye. So what I did is I realized it was time to do a bit of my own medicine, to take a taste of my own medicine. So I asked one of my students, a wonderful woman, to sit with me and to follow this and see where it would go. And the first thing that came up, again, in somatic experiencing, we don't go right to the trauma, was a memory that happened when I was 4 or 5 years old. It was my birthday. And in the middle of the night, my parents must have come into my room and laid tracks for a model train underneath my bed, out into the room, and then back underneath the bed again. And when I awoke, the train was going around on the tracks, and I literally jumped out of bed, went to the transformer, controlled the speed, make the horn go beep, beep. And in that moment, I mean, my body was so excited, was so alive, the opposite of what happens in the trauma, which is important because we need to get new experiences that contradict those of traumatic overwhelm and helplessness before going to them. And so that's where, in a way, where I started. But then some other images started to come up that were disturbing. And as we went on, and she helped guide me, at first she noticed a very slight movement of my feet, and she brought my attention to it. And I could feel like they were running. Then another positive image came up. There was a park across the street from where I lived. It's called Reservoir Oval. It's a lovely park. And when I would get back from school, I would just have my milk and cookies, Pepper's Farm cookies, and then run across the road and climb the fence and then go down through the bushes. There was a cinder running track below. And so I would run there and I would feel my legs moving. And this was important because my legs were being pulled out from under me because of the threat that we had from the mafia, from a man named Johnny DiGuardo, a murderer, one of the most murderous of all of the people. He was he was one of the characters in the Goodfellas and also in The Irishman as one of the most violent ones. And they were trying get the DA, the district attorney, was trying to get my father to testify against him. This is a long, long, long story. My father was completely innocent, but then they told him, my father, they told my father that if he ever testified, then he would find his family, us, face down in the East River. Cleveland. So being able to run, to be able to feel some power in my legs was also important. So then from there, another image came up. And it was a different time. I was climbing the fence, and I noticed off to the left, there were a bunch of, looked like they were from a gang. And they were smoking cigarettes, and they had these like motorcycle hats like that Marlon Brando had wore. And I felt the hair on my back stand up. I felt chills. And I somehow knew something was wrong. So I headed down into the bushes and went as fast as I could. But they caught up with me and grabbed me and threw me to the ground. And I don't want to go into the details, but I was violently raped. And the reason was they wanted me to tell my parents about this so they would know how serious the threat was. But I never told them. In a way, I never told it to myself. I put it in the recesses of my mind. It was only those several, many decades later, when I was working with my student, was being guided by my student, that this emerged and I was able to work it through. But I think this happens in some way to most of us. There are some things, and somebody says, well, is your trauma was worse than mine, or my trauma was worse than yours, or something like that. One of the things I've learned in working with people for 50 years is there's no such thing as that. We all have our injuries. I mean, that's the Latin word for trauma is injury, is wound. And we all have our wounds. We all have our stories to tell. And in the book, I really encourage people to write their own stories, even if it's just for themselves. And it can be a deep experience, an important positive experience. So again, that's an example of dissociation. It's something you put away and it's walled off. It's in a compartment, so you don't have to remember it. But every day when I went to school, my body was remembering it. When I walked down the street, my breath constricted, my heartbeat would go up. I would be careful not to step on the cracks in the sidewalk. Very typical ritual that people do to ward off difficult feelings. Mm-hmm. And again, something really changed in my life. I'd lost some of the playfulness, the vitality, although I kept going. And I think one of the things that really helped me is that thankfully, my parents, and they were in many ways sources of significant trauma, but they also gifted me this sense of intuitiveness. My mother was unbelievably intuitive. If you want, I can kind of give you a wrap around on that one. But again, it's like that first image of the train tracks, that was with me forever. I will never forget that image. As I tell it to you right now, I can hear the train going around the tracks, and I can remember knowing in that moment that I was cared about, that I was loved. And that stayed with me. And there's been research that's been done, actually more than one research, that if a person, regardless of their degree of how much trauma they've had, if they've had at least one experience of being cared for and being loved, then they'll be okay. They'll be able to move through the trauma. And it was definitely the case for me. In that moment, I knew that I was cared for, that I was loved. And even though these horrible things happened, that really gave me a foundation, an inner grounding. Yeah.
reflecting back this specific trauma situation, how did it impact you later in life and your relationship? Like many of us, we learn about our traumas from our intimate relationships.
Yes.
And what happens for those of us who do not remember those incidents clearly as you do?
Sure. By the way, in somatic experience, we don't insist that people remember anything. It's just to take the body out of shock, out of freeze, and back into flow. Images may come up, memories may come up, but that's not the goal. And that's another difference in somatic experience than things like exposure therapy, prolonged exposure therapy, where you have the person relive the traumas over and over again, the idea of draining the swamp. But I think it just drains our vital energy in many cases.
How our trauma relieves itself through our intimate relationships.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, for the longest time, I had a real struggle in different kinds of relationships, particularly intimate relationships. And I don't want to say became distorted, that I had more projections, because if I'm seeing the world as being dangerous, then it's not possible to be intimate with somebody else, because that covers everything. And I've been so blessed. I write also in the autobiography of my own sexual trauma and my own sexual awakening. And what appreciation that I have for the people, the women, I'm heterosexual, for the women who have been in my life and who have been so kind and generous and giving and accepting and really allowed me to open again my heart and my genitals together. Because the two of them had been almost irrevocably disconnected. So, and that was a life process. And, somebody wrote, you can't decide who to love or in a way how to love. But if you're touched by love, then you're called by Eros, by the goddess, to be with the other, and to open to the other, and to just feel the sensations and feelings. You know, one of the book reviews was by Diana Richardson. And I don't know if you know about her, but she's one of the main tantric teachers. She lives in Switzerland. She's an amazing, amazing woman. And maybe I just read part of it. At times, this book is heartbreaking, painful, and personal. It's also scientific, informative, and intellectual, highlighting the influence of Eros and letting go an ecstatic expansion while maintaining conscious awareness, brilliant, breathtaking, and masterful. And that was really, I think, what my different relationships did after I had worked through the trauma and also started dealing with some of the other so-called small T traumas. And that was another thing just to mention. The first time I spoke about this in public, it was at the Evolution of Psychotherapy conference, and that usually has several thousand people attending, 5,000 to 8,000 people attending. And so I was talking to this audience, and the topic was it was an autobiography of trauma. And I looked out into the people and I just was absolutely terrified, truly terrified. But then I remembered some of the things that people, my colleagues, friends, and others wrote about the book. And I felt them at my side and at my back. And again, that allowed me to take that risk, to muster courage, to speak about it in a public way. And now as I do it here, I do feel some apprehension, but not much anxiety. I feel excitement. I feel my hope is that this book will really help others in their healing, whether they're therapists or whether they're just all, you know, human beings like the rest of us. And so I'm excited. I'm really excited to help in any way. I mean, the idea actually of being able to help people while I'm sleeping is very appealing to me.
I love that.
So that's a little bit of my story. But maybe I take a side step here. And again, getting back to my mother's intuition. When I was developing my work in the early 1970s, I was also doing my doctoral dissertation at Berkeley. And my favorite restaurant was the Beggar's Banquet on San Pablo Avenue. Apparently, it's no longer there. And
it might reopen after you publish the book.
Maybe. Right. That'd be wonderful. Actually, every time I was doing a retreat in Costa Rica, and they made these wonderful soups for me, because I always at night like to have soup, light soup. And that took me back to being at the Beggar's Banquet, because I would go there. They would usually start by just giving me the soup du jour, along with some French bread, which was like warm, crispy on the outside, warm, moist on the inside. And it was really kind of my self-payment for doing a day's hard work. But one day, something really kind of startling happened. I was starting to eat my soup, and all of a sudden there was a shadow coming from my left side. And I looked, and it was this old man with wild hair and wearing a crumpled suit, which was like three sizes too big. And he sort of motioned to me to sit down. And I shook my head, and he sat down, and I realized I was face to face with an image of Albert Einstein. And so for a good part of a year, now as the scientist, as the rational person, I knew that he wasn't really there, that these are what Jung called active imagination. It's not like mental imagery, it's not psychosis. It's something that really emerges and bubbles up from the unconscious to meet the conscious in this interface, this alignment between conscious and unconscious. So anyhow, I realized I was talking to a figment of my active imagination. That was the rational part of me. But so real that these conflicts, that these encounters went on, and I would ask him questions. And then he would ask me questions about my questions, kind of like in a way, like a Socratic dialogue. And this really reinforced my work, both in developing somatic experience and in doing my doctoral work, basically on the autonomous nervous system, the autonomic nervous system. And finally, at one of the very last times, I was starting to realize that trauma isn't just what happens to us in our lifetime, but may come from many lifetimes in the past, many lifetimes. And so I asked him about that. And he took me in this dream within a dream. He took me to this small pond, and he had in his hand a yardstick, a meter stick, with different stones about the same size along on the stick. And so he took the stick and twisted it, and the stones fell down to the ground, to the water, and it rippled in all directions, forward, sideways, and backwards. But I said, well, what about, you know, the question I had? And then he said, well, if two of these intersecting wave fronts get stuck, then everything after that will be distorted. And so I said, well, then what do I do with this, about this? And he said, Peter, I'm sorry, I don't have that knowledge, but you do. And he left me with that feeling and just supported me. And I again felt so blessed. So 30 years or so ago, long after this, I was visiting my parents in the Bronx in New York. And I was downtown going to museums. That's one of the wonderful things in New York. And I came home and knocked on the door. Well, my mother and father were sitting on a couch. And above them was a bookshelf, several books. And I noticed the one book was The Theory of Relativity by Albert Einstein. So told me to talk about synchronicities. So I told my mother about my encounters with Einstein those many, many decades before. And she stood up straight and she said, Peter, I know why that happened. And I remember thinking, what? What is she talking about? She said, when I was pregnant with you, 8 months pregnant, your father and I were canoeing on a lake in New Jersey, and a wind squall came up and tipped over our canoe, and we couldn't right it, and we certainly would have perished, and so would I. I wouldn't be having this conversation with you because I wouldn't have been alive. And then, just then, this small sailboat came by with an old man and a young woman. And they pulled my parents and me to safety. And then they introduced themselves. I know, it seems too impossible, too fanciful. They announced themselves as Albert Einstein and his stepdaughter.
Oh, my God.
And so the blend between reality and unreality was completely not anymore there. You know, this was active imagination, but it was also something that we had really, that my mother realized, or my mother reasoned, that since that we came together, Einstein and myself, in that time of life threat, and he was, in a way, responsible for me being alive. And so my mother reasoned, and she could, like I said, she can be incredibly intuitive, that that she somehow knew this. She her intuition knew this. And I think if she had been, you know, like in my generation, that she they would have said about her that she was certainly an intuitive, but maybe even psychic. She had this, but intuition again is something I think that I was gifted by her.
Yes.
And when I look back on my life, again, our relationship was very difficult, very, very difficult. And both of them, mother and father, had gifted me in many ways, which I hold even now, especially now, into my heart.
And this was one of the gifts for me, reading about your relationship with your mother, because I had a very challenging relationship. And when I was young, I just put a label, bad. Mm. And as I'm learning and was reading your book, is that it's both. And holding the story that they have given us, the resilience and the trauma at the same time.
Right. Yeah.
Kind of the coherency you said. Or stories that you found through writing the book.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, Zanya, you know, I was hoping that the book would really help other people, like the way you're describing, to reflect on their own experiences, you know, and our parents, no matter how good or bad they were, they're not good and or bad. They're good and bad, bad and good. And I think part of growing up and individuating is when we learn that.
Yeah.
We learn to accept them as they are. And as part of that, accepting us as we are.
The reality becomes less black and white, good and bad, or it becomes more coherent, the word you use.
More coherent, more multidimensional, more colorful, more interesting.
The
thing that they gave me was curiosity.
Yeah.
A drive to curiosity. And again, that helped me in my path. So I'm glad to hear that. I mean, that you, because I think when we all reflect on our parents, somebody, oh, my parents were perfect. Oh, yeah, right. Or my parents were all horrible. Also, that's not so very lovely. But to be an adult and to recognize the gifts that we've been given, and also the struggles we've had, and the word you use, resilience, I think is the accurate word, because even with our trauma, when we come meet the trauma with increasing and greater resilience, then we're able to be much more at ease with some of these horror. I mean, it sounds funny a little bit, but to be more at ease with some of these things that have happened to us, but that we have largely healed. And the healing, sometimes it seems like it happens all at once, but other time it's the beginning of an arc. Like my friend Ian once said, the shortest distance between two points is not a straight line, is not necessarily a straight line. It curves and comes and goes. And that journey is one of kind of finding those pathways between the different events and different experiences in our lives.
If I may, I just highlighted something from the book related to the story you just shared. The question you ask Einstein, how could enough of the fixated point be neutralized so the person could move from fixity to flow, from distortion to an impeded expression and expansion. This transformation, as I learned, involved working with embodied energy patterns that underline ancestral transmissions. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you could unpack a little bit here? This is so dense.
That is a big topic.
Okay.
A really, really, really big topic. You know, all of the work we do and all of the healing we do, it's not in the there and then, it's in the here and now. And although, again, some of these events from the there and then affect us, like Faulkner says, the past is never dead. The past is never even in the past. So these things play out in the here and now, and work in somatic experiencing works with our here and now experiences. But then from that point, we can still reflect back, but we can all respect forward. One of the very interesting things when I was working with these fixated energy patterns in myself and in many of my clients, what would happen, you know, and this in a linear sense doesn't make sense, that actually that would help heal our ancestors of their trauma and their ancestors, ancestors, and ancestors. So in a way, like Einstein was showing me, the way to go forward, it goes forward, sideways, and backwards. And there is no past, there is no future, there's just the time-space continuum. And restoring that with the fixated places that are stuck in the body, that allows those waves to continue to move freely in all directions in a coherent way. So it's a very, I actually have done a couple of workshops basically with this theme of healing our ancestral experiences. And I think it's important. I think it's becoming more and more recognized. And, you know, a friend of mine, a colleague, Mark Wallin. Lovely. He also wrote a little, blurb about the book. And he had a very nice book
It didn't start with you.
It didn't start with you. And very nice. It's very good, simple terms. It really helps people orient to those experiences. But yeah, I think more and more we're really, you know, in the crest of a paradigm shift. I think the old therapies are no longer taking precedence. As I mentioned, in my life, I've been honored with 4 Lifetime Achievement Awards. And the most recent one was from the Psychotherapy Networker. And that's a basic traditional psychotherapy organization. And so the month that I was receiving the award, they have a magazine that comes out 3 or 4 times a year. And there was, you know, those puzzles that have 1,000 pieces and you have to try to put them together. Well, there was a body of a person and there were all of these different pieces together, but one piece was missing.
Mm.
And the caption was, "The missing piece, the body is the missing piece." And I think, again, this is now, I don't like the word paradigm, but it's a new understanding how this is true, how important the body is, because we are impacted by the energy patterns of the world, of the universe, probably, and how we decipher them, how we come to learn about them, how we learn to embrace them, I think is part of the excitement of where we're going now. I mean, your program, SANS, Science of
Non-Duality.
Non-Duality. Because I think really that's where things are going. Where really this idea of simple cause and effect is no longer valid.
Yeah.
And where we are going is where we are coming from as well. You mentioned in your book, you have found similarities with Buddhist teachings, the tradition of
Kumnai, I think.
Yes, Kumnai tradition.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
This goes to another dream. And this dream, I think, was done in maybe 1980, 81. And in the dream, I go into a room and there's a man with a black robe and purple sashes coming from his shoulders down to his, down to the bottom of his robe. And I realized, you know, at the moment in the dream that he was some kind of a spiritual teacher. So then he handed me this wooden box with a brass, a girth, and a lock on it. And without using words, he motioned to me to take the box. And somehow I knew that he wanted me to open this other door, which opened to another room. And at the far side of that room, there was one of these cast iron fence safes. And I knew that I was supposed to open the safe and put the treasure box or the box in there. And then my job in a way was being carried out. So the next morning, the dream made no sense to me. You know, sometimes the dream like just completely makes sense. The other one, like, what is this dream about? And I'm a little embarrassed. It took me so long to really realize what the dream was about. But anyhow, when I looked at the image of the safe in my working on the dream, working with the dream, I recognized that it was this treasure chest that from one of my favorite books, Treasure Island. And so it was a treasure box. And so my task was to take this treasure and to put it for safekeeping. And I think that's what somatic experiencing is in many ways. This is a great lineage from many hundred thousand years. And that I was tasked to put it in a language that would be acceptable to scientific therapeutic of the time, but that really this was an ancient knowledge. Anyhow, about 20 years ago, I happened to be in Berkeley, and it's a bit of a story how I got to meet this person, but I met this Tibetan Lama, and I knocked on the door, somebody opened the door, and he invited me in and poured some cup of tea for both of us, and we sat with drinking our tea together. And he said, well, what brings you here? And I talked a little about what my insights and somatic experience were, and I asked him if there's any correspondence that he knows in Tibetan Buddhism. And he said, yes, there's a tradition called Kumnai. It's a body-oriented tantric tradition. And he said, yes, there's a lot of relationships there. He said, but really, you're talking about a knowledge that has come from many parts of the world at different times and originated in the Celtic Stone Age temple religion. And of course, after our conversation, I ran to Berkeley, went to the library and found a book that had a picture. I think I have the picture here in the autobiography of the Stone Age temple. And there's a door to the portal to the inner sanctum. But in front of it is this ovular stone with two vortices, paired vortices going in different directions. And immediately I realized that was one of the insights in somatic experience, and is our experiences are between two vortices, between two energy vortices. And so there it was. And in a way, I think I had completed my task of bringing this ancient knowledge in a way forward, but in a way which is more understandable in our languaging and how we see things today. And again, I see those things are changing, that we're really honoring these shamanic and even pre-shamanic forces. And I mean, I do talk a little bit about, you know, one of the things people have, when people would see me work or when I was teaching, they would say, well, he's using shamanic. But it's not something that we could do. And I said, that's not true at all. So I wanted to prove that I was not a shaman so that they could learn also. But then, of course, I really found that this linking, this connection with the honor, the privilege I've had to meet different shamans in different parts of the world during the past, 30 years. Mm-hmm. And I think we owe so much to so many of these people that may have been considered to be non-scientific. Mm-hmm. Actually, one of a neuroscientists in Germany wrote a blurb saying a uniting of science and shamanism. And I like that. I could relate to that. It's not one or the other. They have an interface, an interweaving. So here I am.
Wow. And And this brings me to the last question. And you also cover this in your book. You have worked with indigenous communities all over the world, and you have learned from them. And so the question is, what can Western psychotherapeutic approaches learn from indigenous healing practices, indigenous way of understanding wounding?
Yeah, good question. A lot, short answer. A lot. We can learn a lot. I don't want to start with this.
I can read.
One of the things that we tend to see ourselves as individuals.
Right.
You know, when we do therapy, it's individual therapy. That seems like the model. And in some ways, it's been extremely productive. I mean, developing computers and iPhones and iPods or whatever. This was very much individualistic, competitive model. And again, there's great things came from that, but we've lost so much also. And when I started to work with some of these indigenous peoples, it was clear that they didn't see things that way. That meeting some of the chief of the Kernaki people. It's a pretty remote tribe in Brazil. It took us about 20 hours to get there. And when I met with the chief, and he asked kindly, first of all, he could see I was completely sweated, like it was 100 degrees in the noon sun. And so he took me, they had put a little pipe in a crevice of rocks, and there was a spring in the rock, so water was coming out, so it was like a cool shower. So he just took me there and let me just go. And I think in a way he was having me wash away some of my thoughts. And then he took me behind the house he had a bamboo mat underneath a mango tree. And we sat down, and he had some wooden flutes, and he started playing the flute. And I asked him if I could play one of the flutes with him. And he said, that's why they're here. So the two of us played our flutes together, and we got in rhythm. And then, even though my question had partly been answered without me even knowing it, you know, there's a term in Brazilian South American shamanism, a term called sustu, S-U-S-T-O, and it translates as fright paralysis. So I realized, because that's one of the two things that shamans heal, fright paralysis and when a curse is made on somebody. So I said that they must be talking about trauma. So I asked him about that, and he said, yes, he knows about the word sustu, but also he knows the word trauma because his daughter, the first person of the tribe to go to college, told him also about trauma when she knew that I was thinking. And he said, but that misses the point. Trauma is not what happens to the individual, but it happens to the whole group, the whole tribe, and it has to be healed in the whole tribe. And during the time that one of the women, she had diabetes, so she was a high-risk pregnancy. So she went to the hospital about 4 hours, the small hospital about 4 hours from the encampment. And they were stillborn, both, they were twins, and they both died. And she went into a profound depression. And so they were giving her different drugs to no avail. And finally, they were going to give her shock treatment. And so they needed somebody to approve of that. When as soon as they realized that, in the middle of the night, they they took it and they went to that hospital, fashioned a ladder, and the ladder went to her window, and they took her down from the room back to the tribe. And she was, again, you could just see she was in a state of despair. But then as they would do their rituals, she was just, nothing was expected of her. She would just sit on the outside. And then they would do these different rituals. And just doing these moves, I have to tell you, within a few minutes, you were in a different state of consciousness, an altered state of consciousness. And so at one of these meetings, someone started to cry in the group, and some other people started to cry. And then the woman started to sob and sob in her grief about losing her babies. And then she entered in with the group. And the idea is, it's not healing the person. It's taking this on for the whole group, the whole tribe. And I followed the work a little bit of an anthropologist named Marcelo Eliade. And he wrote about this pygmy tribe, the forest pygmy tribe. And when somebody had some loss, they would get together in the group, in the tribe, and they would all start to cry and sob. And this went on for all night. And then the next morning, they would go into the forest and dance in joy and ecstasy. So again, this is really important about realizing our split off view of ourselves, but that we're part of a greater community. And I think this knowledge is...
And this community also reflects to our ancestor, to our...
Yes.
Is out of time and space. It implies the dreams, implies everything. It's just way more complex than we want to...
Right, then we... All,
don't. This has been such a rich conversation. Thank you for your time and for birthing this book and offering it as a gift to the world. I'm sure it will benefit many.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, to every time when we met you, since it was 15 years ago, first time, you do something, you add a puzzle to my life that makes everything makes more sense.
And you are a
You are a mystic. So. You are a mystic.
Right, as much as I deny it.
Yeah,
of course.
It's such an honor to have you.
Thank you all.
Thank you. For everyone, the book is now available. You can purchase it anywhere you buy your books.
Yep.
Somatic Experiencing website. And I just want to also mention, we are fundraising for a dear friend from Gaza to leave. Ms. Basel, young lawyer. And
thank you, Peter. The next opportunity.
Okay. Yeah, till next time. Okay.
Thank you, brother.
Okay, both.
And thank you for listening to The Sounds of Sand. We invite you to explore more of our talks, dialogues, videos, articles, events, and offerings through our website, scienceandnonduality.com. If you've enjoyed this conversation, please consider becoming a member to access our massive library of sand content, available exclusively to sand members. And we would love it if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google, and Spotify. And share this episode with your family, friends, and all sentient beings. Be well.